Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and we're starting a brand new segment on Focus on Albany. It's going to be called Math Mania, and I'm going to be doing shows with my two good friends, Jason Mutford and Zach Benson. So they're going to be teaching me as well as all of you. We're going to talk about different math theories. So math won't seem as daunting to some people as it is. So let's start our conversation off with Jason. Jason, what are we going to be talking about this evening?
I figured for our flagship session on Math Mania, we would pick something that is somewhat familiar, the Pythagorean theorem, which tends to be one of the few things that people remember from their math classes when they go ahead and graduate and then never use math again, or at least never think they use math again. The Pythagorean theorem is a theorem that spans algebra, geometry, a number of other topics in mathematics, but is succinctly stated that given a right triangle, which is like if you took a rectangle and cut it diagonally from corner to corner, you'd have a right triangle. The square of the measurement of the one leg plus the sum of the square plus the square of the second leg is equal in measure to the sum of the square of that diagonal you just cut, which we call the hypotenuse. And you might also just know it as a squared plus b squared equals c squared, as its most common formulaic representation.
So, Zach, what's your thoughts on this?
All right, so the major thing that we use Pythagorean theorem for in my studies, at least at this point, is when we use Cartesian planes, which is two-dimensional planes. It's very useful for telling the distance from the origin of any point that you choose. So, like, if you want to know how far from any two points are, you make a right triangle, basically, which is why the Pythagorean theorem is so useful.
So
the distance from the origin of any point is the x-coordinate squared plus the y-coordinate squared, the square root of that is the distance from the origin.
And I just want to chime in for those who are maybe not as comfortable with mathematics as Zach and I would be. With a Cartesian plane, think about the city streets laid out in Manhattan, where all the avenues are parallel to each other, and then at a 90-degree or perpendicular to that, all the streets are laid out. The Cartesian plane is basically mapping or keeping track of what avenue and what street you're on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Zach?
So, like, if you have, you want to get from 3rd Street and, oh, well, I don't know if I can draw that comparison because I do not live in a city.
In a city, the buildings
like
are kind of in the way.
Yeah, but a bird could fly directly between any two points. So, you see, like, to take those blocks and go to any particular place, the Pythagorean theorem tells you the actual distance blocks that you would take.
Now, for people who never really did well in math or, you know, is going through math classes right now, Jason, why did you pick this to start with?
It's one of those formulas that, you know, as I meet people who are not students or parents or other teachers or mathematicians, you know, and they ask me, what do I do for a living? I say, well, you know, the main thing I do is I teach mathematics. And the Pythagorean theorem seems to be what the average non-math professional immediately accounts. That is the most popular response I hear. They kind of remember the formula. There's almost even a little bit of joy in remembering that some piece of math class. And how simple it is to actually do calculations with the Pythagorean theorem. Both the formula is elegant and the calculations are not unmanageable. For example, there's a thing called the Pythagorean triple, and that's where all three sides of your right triangle are nice whole numbers. And so let's say you had 3 units of measurement on one side of your right triangle, and then emanating out in a perpendicular direction, you have 4 units of measurement. And you say that's a great right angle there. That's a great 90 degrees. But if I could be that bird who flies from the far end of the 4 to the far end of the 3, and I could just go straight there. I don't have to come around that corner. Instead of going the 7 combined units, the bird could just fly there in 5 units. And so 3, 4, 5 becomes a Pythagorean triple because 3 squared plus 4 squared, or 9 plus 16, equals 5 squared, which is 25. And so that, I chose the topic because it seemed very accessible for our first attempt at Mathmania.
Great. Now, Zach, you are finishing up your 4th year, and you're going to go for your doctorate in math and mathematics. As you learned this in college, did you find this really exciting, this theory?
Well, I mean, it's not something that we really had to – the interesting things that we learned about it was more like how it's derived. And, yeah, I found it very interesting. The sort of like the – I like the idea that such a major, like, applicable value of a, like, mathematical just law works. And then when you go to any higher degree, if you try to cube those 3 numbers, you just can't find any solutions. Or if you try to, you could also, like, derive, like, an entire lengthy set of those square numbers. And that's, I think, the first thing we learned in number theory, which was also, like, the first math class that I really loved. So.
Number theory is so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites, too.
So can you explain a little bit about numbers theory?
Well, I mean, sort of the basis of number theory is a lot to do with, like, just you're learning how numbers are related and you're proving things about their interrelatability. And you're, like, in order to really, like, go through it, you need sort of, like, an understanding of, like, set theory, I guess, because, like, you have to prove things, but I guess you do that in, like, geometry class. Wow.
Yeah,
Jason,
it's
number
hard to
theory,
figure out where to start.
yeah, sometimes it is. Number theory, you know, for those who would wonder, you know, who aren't mathematicians, I'm guessing they most likely use an application of number theory all the time without realizing it. Just about every time we put a password into a login that we send over the internet, it gets encrypted. And the design of those encryptions are very much rooted in a lot of things that come out of number theory. I mean, that's one of its predominant applications nowadays.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, computers constantly use modular arithmetic to do calculations.
Oh, yeah, actually, thank you for saying modular arithmetic. People use that all the time, too. We have a 12-hour clock, and every 12 hours it resets by circling all the way around. We just, again, you know, it's one of the many ways we use math and just don't call it math usually, but it's everywhere in our lives at some level.
Okay, what was that? What do you call that thing with the clock?
Modular arithmetic.
Oh, okay. Okay, because it goes twice in 24 hours, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So when you're modular arithmetic is how you sort of process a number. You can process a number modulo 24, which just means that you're dividing the number by 24 and then giving the remainder. So, like, say 97 hours have passed since the last time you checked the clock. And the last time you checked the clock was 12 a.m. or zero in military time, right? 00. So 97 hours later, that's four cycles of 24, which means that you're back to 1 a.m. And you can just say, oh, it's 100 hours. Thank you for giving me that information of 97 hours. Now I know what time it is.
Okay. Jason?
No, I 100% back what he's saying with modular arithmetic. It's got me wondering now, while I prepared for our session today, I did not prepare anything on modular arithmetic as regards to how it interacts with the Pythagorean theorem, and now I feel like I have some exciting homework I can look into. I know that's a strange concept to be happy to have homework I assign myself, and that it's math, but that, you know, I'm sure, Zach, you feel the same way when you have a new thought about putting some math together. Yeah, it suddenly you're like, well, I like my friends, but I also kind of really want to work this out right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now I'm still working on, like, you know, the Hellstone problem, right?
Heard of it. Please remind me which one it is.
Where you start with any integer, and if it's odd, you multiply it by 3 and add 1. If it's even, you divide it by 2.
Okay. I actually know that research very well. I know that exact problem by approximately 5 or 6 other major names. And
yeah,
we should do a show on just on that one problem for sure.
Ooh, we might have to talk about that. I could use some insight.
I'm going to give a shout-out to – there's actually the 3X plus 1 problem book by Jeffrey Ligarius of Bell Laboratories. And he is the predominant researcher and has collected a number of papers published in that area. So we will talk offline about preparing a show on the Hailstone problem or the Kolod's problem or the Ulam problem or the Syracuse problem or the 3X plus 1 problem, all of which are the same thing you just described.
Yep.
Triple and add 1 if it's odd, divide by 2 if it's even, and see what happens.
Really easy to put in a computer, really easy to explain to kids, really hard to solve.
Yep. And that's, again,
the beauty
of math.
The problem today is people use computers, they use adding machines and stuff, and it takes away from people really solving the problem, you know, the problem at hand. Right, Jason?
Well,
did
yes and no.
I
agree and disagree. I think that before computers, when everything was done by hand, we had this great, wonderful set of knowledge to come at math and learn things about it. And then computers come along, and they do a great job at the number crunching much faster than any human can. But I think the strongest advances in mathematics now come from a mathematician who can do both of those things really well. You need to have actual manual number sense to drive your intuition to where you think the theorems are going to be. And then it's really awfully convenient to have a computer hanging around and you say, okay, here's what I need to crunch. And instead of me, the human, taking the next 35 years of my life doing it, I'll just come back in 2 hours and it'll be done for me.
Yeah, I mean, we look at history and all of the people who had to do their problems by hand, and we had a lot fewer advancements and a lot fewer actual, like everyone who did a major advancement in mathematics was fantastically gifted at arithmetic. Nowadays, you
yes.
can be decent at arithmetic and be a fantastic number theorist. Now, I'm not saying that.
Absolutely, yeah.
People absolutely refuse to get into mathematics just because they're not good at arithmetic. But today, you don't really need to be that good at arithmetic to be a mathematician.
Yeah, you need to be good at seeing what good arithmetic is, but you don't have to be the one who actually does the good arithmetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what you planned for today, Jason, can you give us an overview of what you'd like to talk about in our first episode?
Well, let's see. I have a number of bullet points that we can delve into. First, we could get into the actual recorded history of Pythagoras, although the more we get into that, the more we realize that almost every fact of Pythagoras has some fact that contradicts it elsewhere in recorded history. We could actually try to discuss the actual proofs of the Pythagorean theorem, or even if we can't get into that on the medium of radio so well, I definitely at least want to discuss how many proofs of the Pythagorean theorem they are. It's one of the most celebrated and proven theorems in all of mathematics. I'd love to maybe take an aside to talk about three other little things. One, the relationship of the Pythagorean theorem as regards to how it is we design manhole covers for the streets, for the sewers. There's an important relationship there. Fourthly, I wanted to talk about shift in education. There were two questions that were almost identical, given in very different contexts, and they're based in a three-dimensional version of the Pythagorean theorem. We're definitely going to talk about getting into Pythagorean theorem outside of a flat sheet of paper, and it sounds scary, but it's actually not significantly harder at all. And then I was going to hit very, very briefly onto a side note about Einstein's special theory of relativity and how the Lorentz transformations, which is some formula that came out of that research, is really as scary as that sounds. We all go, oh, Einstein's the pinnacle of just, you know, being a human brain outside of what normal intelligence is. And so this Lorentz transformation formula is really just the Pythagoras theorem in disguise. And it's just a neat conversation to have. So, you know, those five things, the history of Pythagoras, the person himself, some various proofs, talking about the sewer coverings and how the Pythagorean applies, a footnote on achievement tests, and a footnote on Lorentz transformations.
Okay, so let's get started.
Okay, then. Well, I was going to share some facts then of who Pythagoras was. He existed about 2,500 years ago, and one of his translations of his names was Pythagoras of Samos, which is kind of, it's not the heel part of Italy, but kind of the midfoot part of Italy, sitting right on the Mediterranean Sea. He founded a school in Croton, where his members were sworn to secrecy. They lived in communal houses. There is stories that he prohibited them from eating beans, and that they should be vegetarians. And so already he sounds like an interesting, weird, mystic character. It turns out that his communal, I don't know what to call it other than a cult, really. It kind of was a cult. They were very much against democracy, which was then kind of an up-and-coming idea. I mean, democracy is very, very much more popular in the 21st century. And the people who were in favor of democracy actually went around burning down many of the schools that were like Pythagoras's and would often kill people in the process. And that's one of the main reasons we don't have a lot of actual fact is, A, they didn't like to write things down, and B, when they did, their houses got burnt down. So it's unknown if Pythagoras actually died in one of his own schools in Croton, but there is also the occasional reference that he escaped to Metapetum, I'm hoping I pronounced that right, which is a little bit further north in Italy, to quietly live out his life. And then the coolest thing was the Pythagoreans also believed in metempsychosis, which is the transmigration of eternal souls to new bodies. So he claimed, or at least somebody claimed, that he claimed to be reincarnated, that he would often hear voices of his friends in animals he encountered. This just sometimes when they say, a touch of genius is also a touch of madness. Pythagoras would be not far from that description.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to pause here in case you have any reactions to who this person was. If you want to talk more about him, it's just an interesting person. Oh, and the other thing is, it is one last fact. It is claimed that he's actually the person who coined the word philosopher, meaning the lover of wisdom.
Well, I'm sure did lover mean anything else back then? But
it could have.
Was it perhaps a euphemism? Also, another Greek root.
Actually, I'd be surprised. While there are accounts of Pythagoras having married and even had children, there are actually far more many accounts that he looked poorly upon people succumbing to physical pleasures. That they would have to acknowledge that they're turning into their weaker selves when they partake in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Like Aristotle talked about that a lot too. Like the ideals.
Yeah. Aristotle was very influenced by the Pythagoreans.
Yeah, I'm really glad that, not to judge from any puritanical, our current existence. I'm glad most of that isn't really taught in the schools when we talk about the Pythagorean theorem.
Go ahead.
Part of the reason why that might not be so necessary to be taught in schools as well is I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Pythagoras alone originated the Pythagorean theorem.
Oh, yeah, he absolutely did not originate it. Current research has revealed there were two places in the world. I think it was the Babylonians and the Indians. Both had an awareness of the Pythagorean theorem. And in my research, I didn't come across, but I seem to remember China also knowing it. And I want to say as much as 800 years prior to Pythagoras' time, so as much as 3,300 years ago.
And we probably get that it's the Pythagorean theorem because of, the conquerors of the Romans, of the Greeks, directly after, and then all of our, because they mainly use the Pythagorean theorem for its practical applications, right? So they would have been we just found the Greeks.
There were two main things they used it for. It was stuff like astronomy and then stuff just like actual terrestrial geometry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. A bit of history.
Did Einstein use this theory a lot?
Of course.
Yeah, that would be a good segue for me to to talk about the Lorentz transformation connection. But first, I would have to discuss what the Pythagorean theorem looks more like when it jumps off the paper into three dimensions or four dimensions, and so on. So earlier we had said a squared plus b squared equals the hypotenuse squared. And that would be a two-dimensional Pythagorean theorem where a and b are measured at right angles to each other. So think one might be a north-south kind of measurement and one could be an east-west measurement. In three dimensions, we would say a squared plus b squared plus c squared equals that hypotenuse squared. So it really is as simple as just putting one more squared number into the set of things you're adding together on the left side of that equation, and it still all adds up. The sum of those squares is going to be the square of your hypotenuse measurement.
And the deriving that is actually really simple. You really, like, you can imagine a cube, and you have A and B a rectangular prism just for generalization purposes. But so A and B are the flat plane that you're starting on, and then C is the z-axis, essentially, which would be the extra axis that you're adding when you're talking about Cartesian coordinates. And so you find the hypotenuse of A and B, and then you've now made a new flat plane originating from that and at a right angle, so it goes directly on the z-axis from there. And then you can see that the distance on the z-axis that it travels is exactly the same as your C, the leg, because it's like it lies on that shape. Like the line is tangent to it. I guess tangent's the wrong word, but it works. And
so
your other line is your hypotenuse of the first triangle. So then you square that and you find, oh, all of a sudden, A squared plus B squared, the square root of that squared is just A squared plus B squared. So A squared plus B squared plus C squared, the square root of that is your new distance.
So for those playing along at home who aren't as comfortable with x-axis, y-axis, z-axis, I'm going to try to make this something you could actually test out in your home if you wanted to play along at home. Grab whatever box that you have at home, right? So three dimensions, it's got a front, a back. That's one. That's one way you can look at the box. It's got a left, right, and it's got a bottom and top. And I'm going to keep the numbers simple, but you can try this out with an actual tape measure and whatever your numbers are. The formula should still work, no matter what the numbers are. So let's say this box I have in my house, when I put it on the table in front of me, it is 4 inches wide. And then I go to measure, well, how thick is this box, meaning measuring from me and moving straight away? Well, it's 3 inches thick. So 4 inches wide, 3 inches thick. Ignoring how tall the box is, I can measure the diagonal of the bottom part of the box that's sitting on my table. 3 squared plus 4 squared is 5 squared. So I would know, I could take my tape measure and I can measure from corner to corner on the bottom of my box and get 5 inches. And then what Zach was explaining is you could then treat the 5 inches as if that's the bottom of your next right triangle. Mm-hmm. And now you'll say, okay, I've got the 5 inches across the bottom of my box, but now let's talk about how tall my box is, and it's a full 12 inches tall.
Okay.
And so now if I wanted to measure from the lowest, closest corner on the left to the highest, furthest corner on the right, so I'm going directly all the way across diagonally through this box, the shadow beneath this measurement is the 5 inches we just measured, so 5 squared. The height of the box is 12 inches, so 12 squared. Add those two numbers together, 25 plus 144.
169.
We're going to get 169, which happens to be a perfect square. It's 13 times 13. And so now this distance all the way across the box from the closest bottom left corner to the furthest top right corner would be exactly 13 inches. And as I said, you can play along with your own measuring tape and whatever boxes you have around your house, and your numbers are probably not going to work out as nicely, but when you, you know, allowing for rounding errors and precision concerns, you'll see that a squared plus b squared will get you the c squared, which is the diagonal across the bottom of the box, and then you use that c squared with the height squared to get the three-dimensional diagonal of the box. And this leads back to one of the other bullet points that I wanted to talk about. There was a question just exactly like that. It involved a box, and then there was a straw that went from one corner of a box all the way to its complete opposite corner. And this appeared on a thing called an achievement test, which I think they now also call the SAT-2s. And this was there were two levels of mathematics achievement test. There was an entry-level one for, like, sophomores in high school, and then there was a higher level two achievement test. And I remember being in high school, and we encountered that particular question in a practice set. Our teacher had given us a released copy of the test to practice to see if we were going to take these achievement tests or not. And that was the question that nobody could figure out. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before, and the data on the test was only 6% of these students who actually thought they were good at math, right? The hot shots who were better than the Math 1 test and going for the Level 2 test. Only 6% of them even got that question correct when the test was actually administered. And what I in the history of New York State mathematics, anyway, we're here in New York State, we have Regents exams, and they used to be 9th, 10th, 11th grade, and then they were integrated Math 1, 2, and 3. And then there was this Math A, Math B, where they took the 3 years of math and broke them into year-and-a-half segments. And on the Math A test, almost exactly the same question was being asked. And just, you know, to let you know, that went over even worse than, you know, the Math Regents was being given to everyone as a graduation requirement. And so when you had your very limited self-selecting set of students willing to pay money to take an advanced math test, and only 6% of them got it right, and one of the first times they throw this Math A Regents out to everybody in the state, 6% looked really high, because that's not how that question worked around the state. I mean, their intentions were good, that they want to have students thinking mathematically more, but they the learning curve on that was very steep.
Zach?
Okay, go ahead and ask your question.
Zach, do you have anything to follow up with that?
I mean, I can speak to taking those exams, and I mean, I don't remember any particular questions that were super difficult. I remember, like, a lot of math counts, and, like, later on, like, the high school equivalent to math counts being very much, they tell you these things and you derive it as like a group, which was a lot better, a lot more fun than what we would do in regular math classes, which is mostly just like the same problem over and over again, right? Which is what the Regents really
math is. Math counts was your enrichment mathematics outside the math class and going to competitions. Or competitions being brought to you, right?
Fantastic.
I don't know if Cynthia mentioned to you, I actually contribute questions and help edit the actual New York State equivalent for high school competition, New York State Math League, and now also the national level, American Regents Math League.
Nice.
So I'm I'm very familiar with here's high school math, and then here's this competition level math that uses the same building blocks, but really just goes that much deeper into you know, how to use it and how to hide the tricks of the formulas so that you don't instantly know them, but then when you find them, there's a deep satisfaction that, like, oh, that's what that's built on. But you're right. Like, you know, when you're in some kind of math count setting, you are shown outside the box, the proverbial box, math questions, and you have to figure out how to use your knowledge in a very clever fashion.
There's so much less pressure on you to, like, absolutely recommend it to, like, especially people who are, like, disinterested in, like, just doing arithmetic in their math class, right?
Yeah.
It's very, very little of that, a lot more of just, like, seeing the patterns and, like school a lot of times beats the crap out of your ability to creatively problem solve, and
yes,
stuff like this does the opposite.
Yeah, there's, well, I mean, I know, like, Dell Publishing and Penny Press Publishing have they publish crosswords, but they also have variety puzzle books as well that are available usually where magazines are sold. You know, you can go to the supermarket and sometimes get them. And those are, like, entry-level problems. And then with Zach's talking about the maturity of the mathematics higher up.
They respect they expect you to, if you can't solve the problem, you'll go back afterwards and figure it out, and it'll help you solve the next problem.
Yeah. And that all helps develop your appreciation and your intuition for the mathematics. And as you said earlier in the show, you don't necessarily have to be good at arithmetic to be good at math, because math is, you know, a lot of people, I think math is only numbers. And you know, I find helpful, you remind them they took a geometry class, and they go, oh, yeah. Oh, well, there weren't that many numbers in geometry. And they go, oh, okay, then why do we call it math? But math is really the art and science of manipulating ideas.
Yeah.
It's one of the most purest forms of thought. It's really not just about numbers.
I'm going to go back to Einstein again. And his,
okay.
In the latter years of his life, didn't he communicate by just mathematics alone?
That sounds like a wistful rumor to me.
He did, when
okay.
He was on his deathbed, he left, like, a sheet that just had, like, a ton of math on it. But, I mean, I've heard people say that it was just, like, basic calculations related, that he was, like, trying to figure something out. But really, it's probably not something so mysterious as trying to communicate with people through math.
That was reminiscent of something else where Zach had said that instead of squaring these numbers, if you tried to raise them up to a third power or cube them, raise them up to a fourth power or fifth power, this formula doesn't work. So it only works when they're being squared. And that's called Fermat's Last Theorem. And he had written some notes in a margin somewhere saying, oh, I have a proof for this.
Mm.
And then never actually wrote the proof out, and he passed away. And it took 400 plus years and the world of mathematicians before finally this gentleman, Andrew Wiles, goes up into his attic every night for like 7 years and mostly proves it. And then I think there was one little misstep in his proof that somebody caught, but then they patched up and it really, finally it was proven that Pythagoras had the highest exponent you could use.
How many pages was it?
I think it was 40. The gentleman's name was Andrew Wiles, and I think 40 sounds low. If I recall, he gave like a 3-day seminar, like start to finish with maybe a break for lunch, on his findings. And it wasn't until the third day that anybody realized a side effect of what he was talking about, by the way, was this proof that mathematicians for 400 years have been fighting for,
mm-hmm.
that is built on the backbone of Pythagoras. And then Fermat chimes in, he has this proof. And, it was one of those, like, I don't think he necessarily realized himself how monumental what he had built was until presenting it, kind of like, oh yeah, wait a second, this is a good plot twist at the end.
So Jason, what is your vision for these discussions? What would you like to see happen?
Absolutely adored that while we have a main topic to discuss, that we've actually meandered off topic and back on several times. I feel like
uh-huh.
that is much more authentic to what mathematics really does. One of my, my concentrated area of research is on what you can make a fair coin do in the realm of probability. And I have this beautiful proof now that I can basically make the probability of a game that uses nothing but a fair coin. I can make it be whatever rational probability I want it to be. So some whole number divided by some other whole number. And as long as that fraction is between 0% and 100%, you tell me, you know, what you want the numbers to be, and I can do it. And that research, I had to go through no fewer than I think 5 distinct topics of mathematics to come up with what amounts to this now concise 7-page paper. That's the other thing I think the audience might not fully appreciate. Whereas, with Charles Dickens, I think was paid by the word, and these very long, you know, monotonous sentences got written much longer than they needed to be for the stories they were telling. The mathematician works exactly the other way. You almost get paid by the words you don't write, just as long as you do have a story to tell.
Zach, what's your vision for this podcast?
So, I mean, I just want, to build up to a point where, like, we can have these discussions and we can... I mean, it'd be fantastic if we could involve you more, Cynthia, and we could have you be more than like a moderator, and hopefully we'll build up. Sorry?
I was going to say, thank you for reminding me. I forgot we were, I see that at the end of every one of these focuses, we're going to test Cynthia at the end and see how she does.
What?
I'm joking.
No. Yeah, so what I hope is we can build up, like, enough of an understanding that we can just sort of, discuss topics and maybe eventually, like, work on some type of actual theory, possibly, depending on what our interests collide on. But, like, first, I think we have to go through and, like, roll in the basics and make sure that if we try to do anything, we can really like point to like this episode, we discussed this. And if you watch all the episodes, you can really understand any complex topics we want to talk about.
Well, since this is our first show, as we were going on about, you know, the theory, I created a Facebook group, and it's called Math Mania. So everybody who's listening, please join our group and listen to what we've said in the interview and share your thoughts about what we've said tonight. Jason?
And yeah, I know this is probably going to be a pretty shaky first session because we're not – like, I think I've talked to Jason 3 times. And so
yeah,
we're
right,
still getting
right.
used to each other. So.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That's
everybody's
right.
got to meet other people.
Yeah,
you know,
and I felt very at ease having these conversations with you more and more with everyone we've had. So
mm-hmm.
just like any show, has to have a few episodes to kind of stand on its feet comfortably.
Right.
And hopefully we go through
right.
this awkward phase quickly. Actually, I don't even feel like it was too awkward.
Not that bad.
No. It didn't flow as naturally as it should have, but within a couple of shows, we'll get that down pretty pat. So, you know, you shared your vision, Jason. What would you like to see as your audience?
Let's see. Everyone in the world and... No, no, really. I think anyone who enjoys wondering about the world, just has a fascination about things and is, you know, maybe they might be intimidated with the content we're going to approach, but not so intimidated that it disinterests them, more that maybe we hit that sweet spot that we do take somebody a place that they haven't gone yet, and they're not sure they want to go to, but their curiosity says, I'm going to take a leap of faith here. And then they come out the other side of that leap, and their curiosity is now rewarded with 2 things, some knowledge they didn't have in the first place, and then secondly, much more curiosity that they want to keep taking this leap of faith and look deeper into it. One of the best things in the world, I think, is having a curiosity and following through on it. And, I mean, that comes from my mathematical training, but it's also the root source of what I do with my mathematical training. Sorry, Zach, go ahead.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I think that's absolutely the audience we want to reach, everyone in the world.
Well, Zach, you're going to be going for your doctorate degree in math. So do you think talking in these shows will help you and help your friends?
I think it's always good to involve as many people as possible. And, you know, plenty of great ideas have come from just like somebody who maybe doesn't know so much about a subject, just like saying some off comments that you latch onto. And that's like why we have so much going on in so many fields nowadays. We just have so much interaction going on between people. And I have no problem fostering that.
Yeah, actually one of the most employable things about being a mathematician, and most people don't realize this. Earlier I said that math is the art and science of manipulating ideas. It's not just about the numbers. If you can ask great questions, you are a mathematician. And so, you know, I'm hoping that that's also who our audience is, and I hope that's who we can reach. Piggybacking off of the vibe that I sent Zach was saying, like really getting people to the point that they're asking about stuff. You know, it's amazing to hear, like, well, okay, you're a mathematician, you're going to crunch some finances. No, that's math, but that's not the heart of math.
Yeah.
The heart of math is you have some sort of research and development group, and they've kind of been stuck for a while. And the number one person you want to kind of hire is a mathematician. They're going to come in, and they're not necessarily going to know what's going on. They'll have to be brought up to speed. But you're going to want to hire that mathematician because they're going to ask the right questions. And so I would love to see the world have a lot more questions, because a lot more questions leads to a lot more answers.
So you guys are going to put me on the hot seat?
Soon enough.
No, maybe not this first episode, because I just kind of sprung
okay.
that on you. But, you know, we might encourage you to be able to jump in and see how well you do with, you know, I don't know what prizes we can offer you. And, of course, we'll have to put on some sort of, like, 60-second countdown clock so you feel pressure. No, none of those things. But, I think the real hot seat wouldn't be at the end of the show, but just that along the way, your questions come out, that it's not just asking us what we want to talk about, but you dig in and say, hey, you know, for example, you mentioned that thing earlier about the manhole covers. How does that connect into Pythagoras? And we might say, well, before we share what the connection is, take a guess. Now, you still don't know? Okay. So the shape of those covers are that they're completely round. And the reason they're completely round is because, let's imagine they weren't round and that you had this nice rectangular shape, and the heavy metal cover were also triangular. So as you go to lift this rectangle up, if you rotate it at an angle, what winds up happening is now the largest side of the rectangle is smaller than the hypotenuse of the hole in the ground, and it could drop right through.
Oh.
And so it's because of the Pythagorean theorem, and I guess also some very unfortunate early engineers who lost certain covers down into the sewer, they decided to shape them in a more circular fashion. And this way, no matter how you rotate that circular cover, there's no hypotenuse of the hole in the ground that's going to be larger than the cover itself. And now we no longer lose those covers down into the sewer.
Oh.
Yeah. Interesting engineering feature. And connected to our core concept.
I never. So,
yeah.
Go ahead, Zach.
No, I never. Wait. Okay. So would that be true? Is that true of every shape except a circle, like an ellipse?
I think with an ellipse, because you have a longer axis and a shorter axis. I mean, an ellipse would be a lot less likely than a rectangle to fall down the hole if held wrong, but you could orient an elliptical cover in such a way.
Yeah, you could.
That you could absolutely, you know, say, oh, well, now that this thing has been rotated onto its narrow side, it fits through the hole. Plunk, sploosh.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because also, like, you could probably write a proof pretty easily for that. Yeah, I could imagine doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Extending it to all the polygons. Yeah, okay.
So, we've been talking for an hour, so let's kind of close up on this session, and as I said, I created a Facebook group, Math Mania. Everybody that's listening, why don't you join the group and kind of share your thoughts about what was said tonight, and as our programs evolve, your thoughts will be very helpful to keep the conversation going. So you've been listening to Zach Benson, and Zach is going to be going for his PhD in the fall. He's just getting his bachelor's degree. And Jason Mutford, who's a math teacher in the city of Albany. So If you like this, please join the Math Mania Facebook group. Hey, guys, thank you so much. We'll talk again. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great night.
Thank you for having us.